Shall we, Megan?
Let's do it.
We shall. Hey, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we try to make today make sense.
And I'm Megan McCarty-Carino. Thanks for joining us today. It's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. It's our chance to answer some of your burning questions.
Yes, since you don't want to just hear our questions, we're going to hear yours and do our best to answer them. And to kick things off today, let's turn to a question that is right up your alley, Megan, workplace reporter extraordinaire, that comes from Mark in Alaska.
On the show, you've discussed both the housing crisis and companies starting to offload office space in the wake of COVID. I don't suppose there's any chance those two could complement each other to come up with a solution. Make me smart.
Such an interesting question, especially, I think, coming from Alaska, where I'm not sure if there's a lot of empty office buildings, but it's definitely the first thing I thought of when I thought of, you know, all these people leaving offices is, hey, what do we have? We have a housing crisis. But apparently there are some issues with just moving into the office. Like, I'm thinking of, like, George Costanza just, like, moving in under the chair of his, you know, like, under the desk of his office. Like, if people did that, if people were willing to just, like, move into an office building, then that would be easy, problem solved. But unfortunately, people want to live in somewhat normal dwellings. And I guess that is kind of where some of the complications come in. There are some technical design issues with what works architecturally for an office versus what works for an apartment building. And some of those things would need to be worked
out.
Light. You know, exactly. Yeah. Some, many offices, you know, don't necessarily have windows that open or windows that have light or, you know, bathrooms and plumbing and things like that. So all of that would need to be worked out. There's also zoning regulations, building codes are very different.
Right, because if a building is zoned for office space, can you just switch it to make it now residential? I imagine
not
there's
in
different
most places.
Rules for
I mean,
bathrooms and elevators and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, and in the kinds of cities that we're talking about, the San Franciscos, you know, the Bostons, that these expensive, you know, coastal cities that have housing crises, a lot of times it comes down to zoning. Zoning has been an impediment to building more housing in these places before this issue came up. And there's a lot of local control. You know, local governments have a lot of control. Local, you know, kind of housing groups and neighborhood groups have a lot of control over this. And oftentimes stop density, you know, dense housing zoning from going through. So that's one thing. There is actually
backyard.
A bill in California to allow housing development in office and retail zones. Like many bills in California having to do with building or having denser housing, kind of up in the air where that's going to go. But apparently in San Francisco, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, there's 16 million square feet of vacant office space, and there have been no housing proposals submitted because of some of these obstacles. So we're still a little ways away, but I don't know if you've ever watched the British show Grand Designs. This is one of my favorite shows. It's on Netflix. It's
no,
on Hulu.
I haven't.
So these British people, they go and they convert, in many cases, they convert buildings like a Victorian water tower into their house. And it's all about these, like, multi-year projects where they try to take on these crazy building projects. This episode that I'm talking about was one of the craziest. And if they can convert a Victorian water tower into housing, surely they can convert a brand new office building into housing. I believe it can be done. There are some challenges to doing it. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I don't know. Would you want to live in a converted office building? I don't know.
I did, actually.
Really?
My last apartment was a converted office building. And
actually,
it was fine.
Yeah. No, I know that downtown LA has a lot of converted office buildings from the early 20th century. It was when downtown LA started revitalizing. One of the big things that helped create housing there was they were able to convert these old office buildings into housing. I know some former marketplacers that lived in some of these buildings. And so they changed the law to allow these buildings to be converted into housing, even though they didn't have parking because they were from the early 20th century. And that is how downtown LA became kind of a happening spot. So,
yeah, I know this is of super interest to people in DC because, like many cities, we have a ton of construction, a lot of new office building, a lot of new mixed use development, but definitely not enough housing, especially for lower income folks. So, with all of these office buildings going up, people really are eyeing these big buildings and saying, hey, here's a great opportunity. But you wonder, for these developers, does it make sense to convert it into housing and get into the rental ownership market? Or do they really want to just kind of sit on that stuff vacant until hopefully the market recovers or something else happens? But let's look at our next question. What's up next, Megan?
All right. Our next question today comes from Karen in California.
It seems like every day there's yet another example of violence against Asian Americans. Not to mention other forms of race-specific harassment, like vandalism, threats, and online savaging of their businesses. Since the pandemic began, we've seen Asian American businesses cut hours of operation for their safety and have to hire their own security. All of this seems to be made worse by the lack of reporting about incidents in mainstream media, plus the rhetoric of U.S. foreign policy on China. What is the economic cost of anti-Asian American racism? In the context of Build Back Better, how much relief funding has gone to Asian American businesses?
Look, the economic cost is obviously secondary to sort of the personal safety cost, but there is an economic cost. There was a really good piece about this in the Washington Post recently, talking about how Asian American business owners had to hire additional security, cut back hours, dealt with the drop in business. I interviewed early in the pandemic a professor named Robert Fairley who was quantifying just how much of a drop in business that various minority groups had as early in the pandemic. And it was worse for Black-owned businesses and Latinx-owned businesses. But number three was Asian American-owned businesses. And that could potentially have an even stronger impact. But according to data from the U.S. government, Asian American-owned businesses actually pull in more revenue than a lot of other minority-owned businesses in the aggregate. So just the fact that there has been that big drop as a result of the pandemic, you know, it amounts to dollars. And how much of that is attributable to discrimination and racism, it's hard to parse that out at this point. Now, in terms of what resources are going out, I know that the Biden administration has said that they're very much taking a racial equity lens to how these funds from the American Rescue Plan get distributed. It's still happening. We have to see the numbers. And a lot of times the businesses that take the PPP loans or the emergency assistance, maybe they don't identify exactly what their racial or ethnic background is. So that makes it a little bit harder to even track that data.
Yeah.
But yes, it is definitely important for everyone to start paying more attention to this because it being undercovered is in some ways why a lot of people, ourselves included, had to just really beef up our coverage recently to make sure that we are spending as much time talking about these issues as we need to.
And when you mentioned, you know, like the PPP loans, I know there were a lot of sort of systemic barriers to, you know, a lot of businesses, immigrant-owned businesses and, you know, businesses owned by sort of underrepresented groups to just get that, you know, that aid that they didn't have, you know, necessarily the relationships with the banking industry. There were difficult ways to sort of quantify some of the costs of the business when you employ, you know, family members and stuff like that, that there were issues in kind of distributing the aid that I imagine would also be complicated.
Yeah. And just I have to lean in on the fear component of it, though. I mean, There were some numbers out of San Francisco State University that there have been at least 3,800 cases of harassment and assault against Asian Americans since March of 2020, mostly women versus men saying that they've been mistreated. But it's just one of the things in that Washington Post article that really stuck with me was this idea that you have Asian American business owners removing artwork and good luck charms and other little just things that make their workplace more comfortable so that the business looks less Asian so that they wouldn't be as much of a target. And I just think that's so awful that you'd have to kind of remove your sense of identity to stay safe at work. And that has some economic consequences as well when people don't want to go to work. Yeah. Okay. We also got an email from Elizabeth in Georgia who wants to know, how has COVID and all its related limitations affected the cosmetic industry? Thank you, Elizabeth, for something lighter. She says, I've been wearing significantly less makeup since I'm wearing a mask at work, and it's made me wonder, with all the remote working, if the cosmetic world has taken a hit. Okay, wow. Megan in the lipstick I see on Zoom.
Yes, to try to properly answer this question, I came prepared with one of my many new shades of red lipstick that I have purchased during the pandemic. This one is from MAC. It's called Devoted to Chili. And sort of like choosing the right shade of red lipstick, the answer to this question is very complicated. There have been a lot of countervailing forces, as I like to say in my marketplace stories a lot, you know? like usually during recessions, things like lipstick tend to actually sell better. This was something that the head of Estee Lauder observed during the 2001 recession and kind of spawned a whole saying, you know, like the lipstick index during recessions, that lipsticks sell better during recessions or times of uncertainty, that, you know, people are sort of looking for an affordable luxury, something to make them feel good. And that kind of runs into masks during the pandemic, which I do have to say I have a few times, you know, after I've spent days in my pajamas, been getting ready to go out for some sort of errand or something, and I'm like, I'll just put on lipstick and I'll feel better. And then I remember the mask, and lipstick is not such a good combo with the mask.
It
so
smudges,
definitely there have
smudges
been
all over
some,
the place.
Exactly. It's messy. It gets messy. Yeah, definitely, you know, staying home, you know, wearing the masks, these things are not the most conducive to putting on a full face of makeup. And indeed, makeup sales declined by 34% in 2020. Our colleague Mariel Segura did a really, really fun piece about how people's makeup routines have changed during the pandemic. And yes, many people are using less makeup, but many people have also kind of taken the opportunity to experiment, maybe try some, you know, different more complicated eye makeup games. And I mean, the skincare industry has actually taken up a lot of the slack. People are getting really into their skin, which I know we have talked about before. I went on a real skincare deep dive during the pandemic, which resulted in me creating a spreadsheet to track all of the sunscreens I was trying. But skincare has done really well. People, you know, because people are into self-care, and actually even cosmetics is starting to do better. The world's biggest cosmetic group, L'Oreal, posted higher than expected revenue growth in the fourth quarter. And L'Oreal's CEO said he expects sales of beauty products to soar again. So, you know, it's been kind of certain sectors of the beauty industry did suffer during certain periods of the pandemic, but there has been a lot of focus on self-care. And, you know, sometimes you just need to put on some red lipstick, no matter if you're doing Zoom or you're wearing the same clothes you were wearing for the last you know, 2 days.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Megan. No,
I would never do that.
Of course I do.
I would never do that.
There was a piece about this in Vox that I was reading in preparation for this question, and I just felt like I was so seen. Like, you know, yeah. First you keep wearing makeup to try to convince yourself that everything is normal, and then you realize that you just don't have to, but then maybe you're buying more expensive makeup since you don't have to use it as much. Yes, that's why Fenty has all of my money now. Mm. And then you try to then you lean into skincare, and I have all these new little rollers and gels and things that I've been trying out.
It's everything. It's a microcurrent device. I got a microcurrent device. I shock my face every morning to try to tone the muscles of my face and make the wrinkles go away. Yeah. But, you know, I did a story earlier, you know, over the summer. I talked to some folks who... they were using it to soothe. There's a lot of soothing things about skincare and taking care of your face. You know, you just want to spray your face with soothing cucumber lavender scent and just calm down. Just buy the skincare.
Well.
All right. Finally, let's get to this last voice memo from Bryce in Connecticut.
I had all these aspirations lately about leaving a voice memo for Kai and Molly, mostly Molly, about mobile cybersecurity and her thoughts on WandaVision. But I kept on chickening out. Listening to Kimberly last night talk about something on last night's pod finally gave me the motivation to submit a question. So here we go. Kimberly, what is your favorite anime that you've watched during the pandemic? Can any season top the amazing winter 2021 anime season? And what new or continuing anime are you most excited for in 2021?
Well, let's see. Yes, it has been an amazing anime season. Absolutely. I cannot tell you that all of the anime that I have watched in the pandemic, because it has been a lot, some of it kind of embarrassing, and so I won't give you the whole list, but the highlights, Demon Slayer, Golden Kamuy, The Promised Neverland, My Hero Academia, Black Clover, Fruits Basket, Darwin's Game, Horimiya. I rewatched Inuyasha because there's a new version of the Inuyasha series that came out, so I had to rewatch the old series in order to get ready for the new series. And then there were these two science-y series that I watched, one called Cells at Work, and then, of course, there was Cells at Work Code Black, which is about, like, they make the cells in the body little anime characters, and they go about all their things. And then another one that just had its new season get going recently called Dr. Stone, in which everyone in the world turns to stone, and then they come back like thousands of years later, and it's kind of epic. But it's all about science and survival skills. So that's some of the anime
I
have watched.
Just some. Just the highlights.
But the winter 2021 season was a really great anime season. Luckily, some of those shows, which were really, really good, laid the groundwork for more seasons and series coming in the future. So I think as more people are getting into anime and more people are watching it, more of it's coming online, more of it's getting dubbed, it's more accessible. There's a lot of consolidation in the industry, monopolies, I guess, okay. I think we're just going to see more great anime. So thank you for your question, Bryce.
So was this such a great time for anime because it was so much harder to do live action stuff that there was just that there were more resources? Was that part of it?
I think it was a little bit easier to get anime from production to people's streaming devices in the pandemic than it would have been a television show because everyone could do their work remotely. But anime was already gaining in popularity in the United States and all over the world before this, and this just maybe accelerated it. Also, everybody watched everything in their Netflix queue, and people were looking for something different.
Yeah.
And there is a long back catalog of anime. Okay, I went way deeper in that. And Megan is just like, okay, I have nothing to add on this.
I know, those were a lot of words together that I didn't necessarily understand.
Yeah, nobody except for the anime nerds are going to know what any of those things
are. I mean,
are.
Look, I made a sunscreen spreadsheet, so I'm, you know.
Okay.
We all have our things. We all have our things.
Okay. That is it for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, please keep sending your questions, emails, and voice memos. We're at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Whew.
long list. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and the Make Me Smart explainers.
Today's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. The same Ben composed our theme music with Daniel Ramirez. Donna Tam is the senior producer, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves.
You should watch some anime. Like, what kind of regular TV do you like? And then I can tell you a good anime show.
Well, I like British TV shows about building things.
I'm going to think about that one. British TV shows about
what
building things.
What is the
things.
Anime
there's
equivalent?
There's a lot of shows set in, like, British-y themes. I'm going to come up with something. I'll ask Daniel Shin also. He knows all the things anime.